So welcome again. And it seems darker tonight. Is it darker? Your faces seem, oh, that would be great. Yeah, so I can feel like I'm on stage. That helps a little bit, thank you. So again, for those of you who don't know, my name is Carrie Peterson, and been a part of SIMS some form or another for about 15 years, but have mostly been away for the last 3 years. So feels a little maybe disingenuous to be kind of having the forgiveness practice sandwiched in between these two talks on wise speech and not mention that largely been absent for the last 3 years, have led a young adult group and done some teaching, but have mostly been away from SIMS. So I wanted to just start tonight by asking for your forgiveness. I know people are listening online as well, and some of you who are brand new or don't know me at all have no idea what I'm talking about. But if that absence has caused you any confusion, discomfort, or additional suffering in any way, I ask for your forgiveness around that. Okay, thank you. I had quite a bit of my own reflecting to do. There were a few more layers of grief than I thought, and I learned a lot from that process of stepping away. And it feels good to be back. It feels tender, and it feels good. So. Also needed to make my priority being a parent for a little while. So anyway, thank you for allowing me to start with that. And it is sort of amazing timing that the forgiveness practice from last week, how many people were at the forgiveness ceremony? Great. Is kind of sandwiched in between these two evenings on wise speech, and this will be the last talk on wise speech before we move on in the series. But the one thing you probably already noticed about speech is that we're always getting it wrong, right? It's a process of continually getting it wrong. We have to somehow make peace with that and be okay with that and continue. So I think the first time I was asked to give a talk in front of a group of people, this was I think 11 years ago now. I don't even think it was language that came out. I think it was just like noises. So we have to really be at ease with imperfection to some degree around speech, right? There's the saying from the Zen tradition, I think it's a 7th century Zen master, to be without anxiety about imperfection. To be without anxiety about imperfection as an expression of awakening, right? So a process. So in thinking about speech, and last 2 weeks ago I spoke about speech is arising out of listening, so kind of one complete gesture, sort of based in wisdom and understanding that what we do matters, that how we speak kind of reflects our mind, right? Is a reflection of our mind. It doesn't arise out of nowhere. But this gesture of listening, receiving, taking in, and then offering. You know, speech arising out of silence, and then falling back into silence. you think about our lives in a human body, you know, we start out in a womb in a completely receptive state, completely receptive, dependent and taking in sound and nourishment and whatever else, but not offering a lot back. And then towards the end of our lives, often, not always, if we have a slower process of dying, we're in this phase of also maybe not offering a lot of words, being again in this state of listening. So hearing is the last sense as we're dying, many of you know. Hearing is the last sense to go. So often people lose the ability to speak, but they're still taking in, still hearing words, still listening. So it feels like beginning and the end is often in the state of receptivity, of listening, of silence, but this whole active middle is filled often with speech and with words. And so how do we practice with that whole messy middle, right? In which we're kind of insured to get it not quite right? Every word that I could possibly say about practice, about truth, about understanding is not quite it, right? It's not quite right. So likewise, our speech is always kind of approximating. And the Buddha, always enheartened by, after his awakening, after his understanding, he took this period of something like 7 weeks in which he contemplated not speaking at all, not teaching. It was actually occurring to his mind, well, this is pretty good. I've done pretty well. What if I just stay in silence? But it was only after he was kind of prompted and could consider it is possible to help alleviate some suffering through this offering, through this teaching. It's only after he was kind of prompted to see in this way, through compassion, that he actually spoke. Through this motivation or intention of compassion. So one of the most powerful tools, and I mentioned this 2 weeks ago as well, that we have in our practice, and it's one I've been working with and reflecting on and practicing with a lot lately, is this quality of sampajana. Often it's paired with mindfulness, described with mindfulness, sometimes talked about as a friend and companion with mindfulness. But it's this aspect of clear knowing, clearly knowing, or full awareness. Sometimes this feels to me like embodied knowing. So the main sutta that this is described in lists all of these activities of daily life. And the instruction or the invitation is to, in all of these activities, is it possible to be clearly knowing? And down to the most detailed and specific activity. So in extending one's limbs out, in pulling them in standing up, in sitting down, in speaking, in urinating, in defecating, in going out, in returning, in all of these activities, can there be this, can you act with clear knowing? So this, I think, really points to mindfulness not as just kind of a cursory or add-on thing that we tack on to our experience, but really a full inhabiting of the bodily sense, right? And this is especially important, I think, when we come to speech, because speech is so quick and our reactions are so lightning fast and so conditioned, so habitual, that to have a very kind of grounded, embodied sense is an extremely powerful ally as we start to come to speech. So Sampajana is also talked about as clearly comprehending, not just a superficial knowledge, but that which leads to a deep understanding of things. So not just an intellectual grasp, but knowing in a full-bodied way. Whenever I read this sutta, it feels to me like, oh, this is the like a tuning of an instrument, right? It's the tuning of an instrument. It's paying attention, or it's playing, or it's developing a sensitivity in all activities. So that when we come to something as charged as speech, we're actually able to discern what's helpful, what's not, what's appropriate, what's not, what's going on in this body-mind with all of this charge, because we've practiced, because we have an embodied sense. So, sati sampajana. And this also, you know, practicing in this way kind of returns us some of our vitality, and to practice in a kind of ongoing, embodied way returns some of our vitality to us. It becomes not just an intellectual exercise or a philosophy we have to adopt, or what seems more common now, a chore that we've got to carry out, right? So I've got to eat my kale, I've got to bike, I've got to, you know, exercise and have my do whatever it is, and I've got to be mindful. You know? It's like something we have to tack on to our experience. But we can, when we can practice in this more sensing into what is it to be human in this moment, what is this full-bodied experience in this moment, we start to feel ourselves kind of thaw or come alive, not so much an adding on to our experience, but a coming alive. So I had a note at a retreat that I recently taught, and this is one of the more joyful notes that I've ever received, just in, I'll read it. So this is from an 18-year-old young man who had never practiced before, right? And tacks, for those of you who haven't been on retreat, you're in silence, so if you have a note for the teachers, you tack it up to the bulletin board. And his note said, "Teachers, is it strange that I'm feeling joyful to just be alive and able to see, hear, taste, and touch? Just this huge feeling of joy just washed over me. I'm wondering if this has also happened to you guys." Christopher. That's not his real name. So coming back to the simplicity of just the ability to see, to hear, to touch, to know, that's part of the process of opening, coming in touch with a more embodied, alive knowing, not just an intellectual understanding. So this is our ground when we come to speech. And what I wanted to work with tonight, or offer for reflection, is one teaching that the Buddha offered his son. And when his son was about 7 or 8, it's said that his son was at the stage in which he was kind of experimenting with exaggeration and telling lies. And so the Buddha came and had a little father-son chat with him and started to share the Dharma with him in a way that was appropriate to where he was at the time. And has all of these components to it, but there's one aspect around speech that I thought would be valuable to offer and to hopefully use in our practice. And this is definitely, you know, it's in some ways it's so easy to speak about all these things, but we also teach what we're learning, right? So learning about this at exactly the same time. So these are the instructions to Rahula at Mango Stone. Rahula is his son. And the first thing that he does is give him these illustrations about how harmful it is to tell a deliberate lie. Right? So he has this bowl of water in front of him in which he washes his feet. Buddha's feet get washed. And so he picks up the kind of dipper that's used to pour water on his feet. And he explains to Rahula, you know, if this dipper is overturned, that's just what happens to your contemplation, to all of your work at contemplation if you tell a deliberate lie. And he goes through all of these examples about how everything once cultivated can really be harmed by telling an intentional deliberate lie. So it's very kind of cut and dried around that teaching. And then he says, what is a mirror for? And Rahula says, well, a mirror is to reflect. He says, the Buddha says, well, just so. It's very powerful to be able to reflect on your own experience, to have the capacity to reflect on your own experience and to know how it is. And specifically in the sutta, he talks about reflecting on your experience before it occurs, while it's occurring, and after it's occurring. And I'll read just one piece of this because I think the language is so helpful. But this, in many ways for me, is so forgiving of our humanity because it doesn't say, just get it right from the beginning and then that's it. Then you don't have to do anything else. You know? It doesn't expect us to get it perfect the first time around. It's this ongoing conversation. So when the Buddha decided to actually speak out of compassion, he started this ongoing conversation, right? That's still occurring. It wasn't a deliverance of wisdom whole that we have to swallow. So many of the teachings are this ongoing conversation that we receive, that we contribute to, that we speak into, that we learn from each other around. So it really feels like we enter when we start to practice this dynamic, fluid conversation that's still going on, that our speech can contribute to. So he has this dialogue with Rahula, and this is what he suggests or what he offers. He goes through actions of body, speech, and mind with the same formula. I'll read the one that has to do with speech. So he says, whenever you want to do a verbal action, you should reflect on it. This verbal action I want to do, would it lead to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to both? Would it be an unskillful verbal action with painful consequences, painful results? If, on reflection, you know that it would lead to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to both. It would be an unskillful verbal action with painful consequences, painful results, then any verbal action of that sort is absolutely unfit for you to do. But if, on reflection, you know that it would not cause affliction, it would be skillful verbal action with pleasant consequences, pleasant results, then any verbal action of that sort is fit for you to do. While you are doing a verbal action, you should reflect on it. This verbal action I am doing, is it leading to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or both? Is it an unskillful verbal action with painful consequences, painful results? If, on reflection, you know that it is leading to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to both, you should give it up. But if, on reflection, you know that it is not, you may continue with this. Having done a verbal action, you should reflect on it. This verbal action I have done, did it lead to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to both? Was it an unskillful verbal action with painful consequences, painful results? if on reflection you know that it led to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to both, it was an unskillful verbal action with painful consequences, painful results, then you should confess it, reveal it, lay it open to a knowledgeable companion in the holy life. Having confessed it, you should exercise restraint in the future. But if on reflection you know that it did not lead to affliction, it was a skillful verbal action with pleasant consequences, pleasant results, then you should stay mentally refreshed and joyful, training day and night in skillful mental qualities. Could you hear those three kind of different outcomes? This is, you know, part of the reading the suttas is a lot of repetition, and for some people this is annoying and redundant. But it's actually a wonderful way for us to really kind of ingest and reflect and deepen with what we're hearing. But the essence of this is that we can reflect beforehand in this way of not so much like an intellectual exercise, but more of that like tuning of an instrument. Is this going in a skillful direction? Is this leading to harm, not just for me, but for others, or to both? And I find this wonderfully kind of thorough and inclusive. If it leads to my harm and not your harm, still shouldn't do it. If it leads to your harm and not my harm, still we shouldn't do it. And if your sense in the beginning is that it is skillful, but you wade into the middle of it, and then there's the understanding, oh, this is leading in an unhelpful direction, then you have the opportunity to stop or continue happily as best we're able. So one teacher who adds on this kind of phrase, Philip Moffat, to many teachings. So may I do this the best I'm able. So you should reflect on this in this way, in this way, in this way, as best you're able, right? So acknowledging our humanness. But then especially afterwards, this reflection after we've done something. Did it have painful consequences, painful results? So Tuari gave a beautiful teaching last week about unintentional harm, right? So if we do something, don't intend at all to cause harm, but see afterwards with our speech, that it was incredibly harmful. So then the instruction is to reveal it, to lay it open, to expose it to the guidance of others, to get feedback. It's not just to swallow it, it's to come forward, to speak it. So the sense is that it's this very dynamic practice that allows us all of these opportunities for reflection, but also learning, right? It's not that we blow it in the beginning and so we just stop. It's like, okay. It's like when we're trying to follow GPS or MapQuest. We just keep rerouting, right? Rerouting, reattuning. And it's as though the attunement system, the default setting, moves from how can I get what I want? How can I get your approval, get your understanding, get you to like me, convince you of my point of view? How can I get more pleasantness? It moves from that to how can I help alleviate harm? Or how can I be increasingly harmless in my actions? So that's what the tuning fork, that's the power of intention, right, of motivation, is knowing where we're coming from. So I think it's helpful to offer ourselves questions rather than shoulds. So in each of these kind of stages, before, during, and after, we can ask ourselves a question. So before we're about to speak, especially if it's heated, especially if it's difficult, we can ask ourselves, what's my motivation here? where am I coming from? And then during the conversation, during the speech, we can also reflect and we can ask ourselves, what's it like right now? Where is this leading? Right? Where is this heading? How many people have entered a difficult conversation with the best of intentions and have begun it only to realize it was not received in the way that you intended at all? Anybody experienced that? Right. So we keep the sensitivity, we keep the tuning fork alive. And we recognize in the middle, where's this heading? Maybe this is not heading in a helpful direction. So we can suspend it. We can possibly change the timing. We can come back another time. We can try a different direction. We can also reflect on the mind state that we're entering with at that moment. Can I let go of maybe some of my own wanting, needing, pushing in this moment? And so in this way, our intentions are purified, not before we speak, but as we're in the process of speaking. So I know I asked for the first few years of my practice, I went around and asked every teacher I interviewed with, how do you have a conversation? I love this practice, I'm in it wholeheartedly, devoted to it, but I have no idea how to have a conversation. Because every time I went to speak, all I was aware of was, in my own mind, was wanting. Was trying to maintain a certain image, trying to get something, trying to get away from something, trying to maintain something. All of these, I thought, okay, this is all old habitual tendencies. I don't want to speak from this, but then what is it that you speak from? It's going to be a lot of silence. So this is an inquiry. We're obviously not just conditioning, but we may have to wait in order for other impulses to arise. We may have to be willing, like I talked about 2 weeks ago, to pause and refrain or step back from those first impulses of speech. So asking before we speak, what's my motivation? Asking during speech, where is this leading? What's present here? And then asking afterwards, reflecting afterwards, how was that? Was there harm caused? What did I learn? Right? And again, we do this not as a chore, not as a strategy of self-correction, but as a learning. Our speech reveals our mind. Speech is an externalization of thought. Our speech reveals our mind. So this is an inquiry, just like we would do in silent practice. And again, moving more and more towards harmlessness, towards a natural understanding and compassion. So I'll just mention briefly some ways, there are many ways, but how do we get stuck in this process of questioning? So as we're asking in this before period, as we're asking what's my motive, where am I coming from? Here we can get stuck often in doubt, right? We can get stuck in this mental toggling of what should I say? Is this right? Is this harmful? Is this true? Is this authentic? And it can be this like mental cogitating, which really is more like doubt. Right? And we can stay in this and never speak. Right? So this is more what I was describing before of my own process, which there was an unconscious assumption that I'm going to wait until my motivations are completely pure before I utter a word. Right? Well, good luck. Right? It doesn't work that way. We see this whole complicated interplay of intentions when we go to speak, often. One moment of kind of wholesome intention, skillful intention, a lot of moments of not so skillful intention. So it takes some courage to move forward anyway, right? To move forward giving primary attention to what's wholesome and trusting the practice and trusting our continued reflection to help purify and clarify the rest as we move forward. Right? We don't have to get it right from the first utterance. So sometimes we get stuck in doubt in that way. I had a yoga teacher once tell me, don't get stuck in openness. Right? It's been a really helpful kind of koan for me over the years. So in that moment of silence before we're speaking, when all possibilities are open, we can get very attached to that moment. Right? But the second we speak, there's imperfection, there's the potential for harm, and there's consequence, right? There's consequence from whatever word is uttered. There's effect from that. So it's risky to speak. So our courage takes different forms. Sometimes our courage takes the form of speaking anyway and trusting the practice. Sometimes our courage takes the form of refraining, really being able to just stop and listen. And in different circumstances, we'll be able to discern what's appropriate when. Right? So it's getting a sense. What's appropriate now? What does courage look like now in terms of speech? So many times on retreat, especially people who are newer, you know, the silence can indicate or mean something very different than it does to people who've been practicing for a while, and there's this sort of preciousness around the silence, right? To many of us who've been practicing for years, there's this real love and appreciation, often enjoyment of the silence. But think about silence in a larger kind of cultural, historical context, it can have all of these other nuances and meanings, right? So we'll often get notes on retreat. Doesn't silence sometimes mean complicity? Doesn't silence sometimes mean inaction or weakness in the face of injustice? So we can have an assumption, especially if we're kind of privileging or preferencing silence, that we cause less harm by staying silent than we do by speaking. So that's a good assumption also to question. Right? Sometimes our practice really impels us to speak imperfectly when harm is being done. So if the tuning fork is tuned to harmlessness, not to perfection, not to premature Buddhahood, where you stay silent and all-knowing, but really tuned to awakening, then often we're really impelled to speak in the face of harm. With as much courage and care and caution and full presence as we can, full bodiedness as we can. So there are wonderful quotes around this, and I'm sure you probably have your own. Many of us who are in kind of social justice work or engaged action, These are some favorites of mine. This comes from Audre Lorde. She has many descriptions of herself, but among the many ways she described herself were black, lesbian, mother, warrior, poet. She's a wonderful essayist and writer. She said, "We can learn to work and speak when we are afraid." Let me start here. Yeah. "We can learn to work and speak when we are afraid in the same way we have learned to work and speak when we are tired. We've been socialized to respect fear more than our own needs for language and expression. And while we wait in silence for that final luxury of fearlessness, the weight of that silence will choke us. What are the words that you do not yet have? What are the words that you do not yet have? What do you need to say? What are the tyrannies you swallow day by day and attempt to make your own until you will sicken and die of them still in silence? What are the tyrannies you swallow day by day and attempt to make your own?" So this is quite fierce. When the silence is leading to our own self-affliction and possibly contributing to the affliction of others, our practice really compels us to speak, to act, and to discern what's appropriate when. So this is part of Sampajana. When is it appropriate to stand? When is it appropriate to sit? When is it appropriate to stay quiet? When is it appropriate to speak? So that growing wisdom. But in my experience, this practice is kind of simultaneously a sort of dismantling of what one thinks one is, a dismantling of that, but also an empowerment. So if it gets skewed in one way or the other, we can be out of balance. There should be some sense of both, I think. And we can feel this in our speech. There should be some sense that the habitual way of speaking is off somehow. We have to have a grand capacity for awkwardness, right? As that old way of being no longer works. We're in this middle terrain of awkwardness, where the new hasn't quite come forward yet. And we have to just feel our way, step by kind of tentative step sometimes. And in speech, we see this over and over again. We feel this over and over again, just the awkwardness of that. So we can inquire, especially around courage. So not to get stuck in analysis, in self-definition, but to let the inquiry come more from a sensing, tuning kind of a place. And then this last reflection about what did I learn? After we've offered something, risked something new, had a difficult conversation, spoken what we felt like needs to be spoken, we reflect afterwards. How was it? What did I learn? So much of this for me, this learning has come around teaching about making myself kind of open, exposing my mind in front of others, you know, in a way that's really not natural or suitable for me at all. I would much rather be listening to all of you. And so now I find that the cramp around teaching, it used to be the whole thing felt like affliction. It felt like the beginning, the during, and the after. It felt like one big affliction. But I could also see that there was benefit. It was extremely uncomfortable, but I could still see there was benefit. Now, or increasingly, there's this after effect. The before, not so bad. During seems to be fine. But there's this retroactive clamp of regret and shame that will often occur. And it occurs for most of us when we've taken some kind of risk against our conditioning, against the movement of habit and staying comfortable. There'll usually be some kind of aftershock or reverberation. Oh, should I have said that? Yeah. And so I'd like to just offer, this has been so rich for me in practice, that if we can in some ways begin to separate the shame piece from the actual learning and the wisdom, it's incredibly freeing and productive. So what does shame say? Shame gets really caught up in regret and saying, oh, I'm the one who did this, right? This action that I'm not sure if was skillful or not, I did this. I am a bad person. I am inadequate. I am guilty. And it really makes the sense of I, the lacking, inadequate sense of I, bigger and more self-involved, right? So this is the movement of shame. And the movement is a cramp. Oh, I can feel myself getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I might as well just go curl up in a corner somewhere, because not reveal myself ever again, right? These are the conclusions of shame. Let me just hide, you know, detach myself from the human race and slink off, right? So we all do this in small ways, large ways. But in this teaching, there are these two really powerful forces that are called the guardians of the world, that can masquerade as the cramp of shame. But they're really our conscience. They're called Hiri and Otapa, the guardians of the world, conscience and concern. Sometimes called moral shame and moral dread. I prefer conscience and concern. Right? It's the part of us that wonders, was that harmful? Was that okay what I said? That's a skillful impulse. That's a related acknowledgement that we have impact, we have tremendous impact on one another. So that kind of sensing into or seeing, was that helpful or harmful? The proliferation and the me and I making around that is not helpful. But that first impulse of, was that hurtful? That's Hiri, that's our conscience. And concern, the kind of worry or tremble in going into something where we know what we say is going to have a big impact. There can be a tremble, a fear of doing harm. That is a healthy fear. The fear of doing harm is a healthy fear. We don't have to let it paralyze us. We don't have to let it take us over. But that just moment of concern for others' well-being is a healthy one. So these are said to be guardians of our own heart and of others' hearts, protectors of the world. So often difficult to really even know that they're there in our present culture as it's operating now, but they are there. And if we're attuned to it, we can see it operating. We can see this kind of natural goodness operating, the sense of a conscience and concern for one another's well-being. And I think it's worth mentioning this. It sounds often really simplistic to mention, but it's good and nourishing for the mind to notice goodness. Right? And especially to speak about it, when we notice it in someone else. So Rick Hansen, the neuroscientist, talks about this as taking in the good. And, you know, so much research now is able to track that when we actually notice the good in others and spend a moment acknowledging it, or in ourselves, harder to do, but acknowledging that, kind of letting the body mind take an impression of that, sense it. All of this I'm not a scientist in any way, but all of these new neuropathways are formed. These new possibilities for future experience are laid down when we acknowledge the good. So I want to just read this to you as well, and then I'll close. This is from Andy Olensky in his book called Untangling Self. There are many good-hearted people in this world. There are many who are truthful and trustworthy, who do what is right more often than not, who sacrifice for the sake of others, who spontaneously feel kindness and compassion. There are some who understand everything is moving and flowing around them, and that one thrives by letting go rather than holding on. There are those at peace who are deeply well, even in challenging circumstances. We may not be able to point to any one person and say they're perfectly awakened, their minds free forever from the three poisons, but surely we can recognize moments of awakened behavior when we see them. So I think it's good to notice this, to make this part of our practice. Often so much of our practice can be about turning towards the difficult, bearing with the difficult, and that's really an important part of what we do, capacity to tolerate discomfort and unpleasantness, but to also and almost equally allow and speak to the good. Gives us a whole wider range of experience we can open to. And sometimes we resist the good more than we resist the difficult. And to speak to it is also a powerful practice. So this process of reflecting afterwards. If we reflect after we've spoken, after we've done something, and again, if it's harmful, we can lay it open to another, use the Sangha, use one another to lay it open, feel like there's been harm to ourselves or others. But if it feels like there's been benefit, like what we've done has been of benefit, we've learned something, it's been of benefit, then we can take some joy in this. This really goes against the grain. We don't have to get puffed up with pride about it. Oh, I did such a good job there. I'm excellent, you know, whatever. Solidify around that. But to enjoy the good, to rejoice in the good, is incredibly skillful and powerful as an action and as a force in the world. It makes it stronger. So this is part of what devotion is. Real devotion is not to a person, but it's to good qualities, good human qualities, whenever we find them, wherever we see them, can bow to that. Okay, so let me end there. I've really, again, there's so many lovely things there, but I will stop. Thank you. Thank you for your attention. Willingness to listen, receive. Let's just take a moment to sit together. So I'd love to hear how you are. What was the effect? And any of your own reflections or questions? Yeah.
This Eightfold Path and Bright Speech has bothered me in many of the ways that you reflected on. And that I grew up in a household where speech was frowned on and you were supposed to listen. That got me into a lot of trouble as I moved on in the world of education and had lots of questions from people that were teaching me, and I became afraid to ask those questions.
Yeah.
And speak with.
Yeah.
It took a long time to unlearn that process.
Yeah.
So I can relate to what you're saying in terms of talking in a group. Sometimes getting the middle ground between silence and speech is a difficult task.
Yeah.
And it's one that I struggled with a long time, so I've appreciated your reflection in that sense. The question I have, however, has nothing to do with that, which is, if you're speaking from the heart, if speaking from the heart is a goal, not a goal, but something that we move toward, is that when you're not offending yourself, offending anyone else, and in both people, or what exactly is speaking from the heart in the sense of what you felt?
Great, thank you. I appreciate that. So there's a reflection first around the balance between silence and speaking, and coming from conditioning where silence was really valued over speech in a household, and kind of unlearning, needing to unlearn that, because that was not a helpful kind of, a skillful kind of silence, more of a suppression maybe than a skillful silence. And so really needing to unlearn that, especially in academic kind of inquiry and questioning, and coming out of that to a place of balance, of when silence is appropriate, that kind of discernment, and when speaking and questioning is appropriate. So that was a beautiful inquiry, thank you. And then a question more around speaking from the heart, and what is that? And how does that fit in with what I'm talking about? So, I mean, phrases that we use, like speaking from the heart, something we kind of use colloquially, and we probably each have a different impression of what that actually means, right? What that actually is, a different experience of that. So when I hear that, it feels to me to mean speaking more from that sense of being attuned to, to not causing harm, right? Feels like I'm speaking from openness, from kindness, from not so wrapped up maybe in my own defensiveness around a position, but I'm speaking from my own authenticity and embodied presence. So if that's kind of how you're using it, I think that's exactly in alignment. And we all have a different experience of what that actually feels like. For some of us, it feels like speaking from the heart. For others, it feels like speaking from awareness. From others, from integrity, from authenticity. But I think it's still good to still use the reflection repeatedly. So you're still checking in with your heart. If you walk into something that's difficult with the intention to speak from your heart, you don't just do it once. That's the thing about an intention. You don't just do it once and then say, well, my intentions were good. This is a really thorough investigation. Well, I meant well. No, it's not that. It's like, oh, I saw that for a while, my heart was open. And then, when he brought that up, oh, I could feel that protectiveness kind of close down, and my speech was coming from a different place then. So, speaking from openness, but then checking in with that openness. Whatever word you want to use for it, but you're checking back in with it repeatedly. And afterwards, what was that like? Not as a standard, again, to measure yourself with, but as a curiosity and kind of for our own benefit and for others. Yeah. Is that helpful? Great. Thank you.
I have a lot of the regret afterwards problem, and I struggle with a balance between separating the shame and the knowledge, and also what to do about it afterwards, as far as whether I go back to the person that I felt unskillful speech with. Because in some ways, sort of approaching them and acknowledging an unskillful speech might be reinforcing the shame that I'm trying to separate. And sometimes I know that it was unskillful, but it's pretty subtle. It's not like I did some, it's not like there was this obvious fight or something. And the more I become aware of unskillful moments and that just internal feeling of contraction, the more I pick up on unskillful patterns, and the more this happens, and then the more I feel like I'm a little bit in a trap of sort of, what do I do when I have that sense of this thing that happened, and how do I make right, I guess, but also stay in balance with not enforcing shame.
Yeah, that does make sense. So the question around kind of getting stuck, it sounds like, in proliferating around regret and feeling as though there was some unskillful action on her part, and it feels like maybe getting stuck in I always think of it as a vortex, kind of a vortex of shame around possibly having caused harm in the past. And if she goes and acknowledges it verbally, does that reinforce, bring you further into the vortex? So first, I would suggest someone asked a beautiful question last time about being on the receiving end of harmful speech and how to hold that. And at the very end of her question, she said something like, how do I find my feet in this? And I thought about that later, and it's like, that's perfect. You have to find your feet. there has to be some sense of ground there, right? Some grounding, some reorienting to, this is an action, this is not who I am, right? And so that can be kind of felt physically. You know, some teachers talk about integrity as a sense of uprightness. There's a sense of, okay, I did this thing with this, with the best knowledge that I had at the time. It caused harm. This does not define me. This is not who I am for all time. And I can be sorrowful about that. I can ask for forgiveness around that. I can go and say, I know this was unskillful. I don't know how it landed for you. I learned a lot from it. I just want to acknowledge that. That's not giving in to shame. That's an empowering action. It may not be an easy one, but watch the proliferation. The proliferation is what causes the shame, causes the vortex. So find your ground. I'm not going to go down that road. And then whether we're on the receiving end or the offending end, acknowledging our impact goes so far. You know, I realize this might have been difficult for you, or this had a really strong impact on me. What makes those interactions corrosive is either self-blame, which is the shame, or other blame. You just acknowledge there's been an impact. Maybe it was enormous. That feels like a start to the. And also some wider recognition that we're all in this kind of process of awakening together, right? And that every time I do something like that, we're contributing, you know, hopefully, to that. Like we grow collectively like that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. How about, yeah? That's something else. Yeah. So know your tendencies, right? Yeah, know your tendencies. There's a quote I didn't read about this idea that our speech reflects our minds. And if we're always apologizing for speaking, you know, then that's reflective of something, of, you know, maybe not believing in our own worth and our own right to. I mean, I have a similar patterning. So we're always moving towards balance, right? And the heart's release. So to take each teaching as it's offered, knowing deeply what our own tendencies are and what would balance look like. So like I said, sometimes it means maybe it's the courage not to apologize, to stand behind what we've said, you know, and acknowledge what our intentions were, you know, and then stop, you know. Maybe that would be the place of discernment or wisdom. There's no like categorical rule, this is how you should do it, you know, that hence the messiness. But you can always sense, okay, what would be kind of going against that tide of conditioning, and then what's the effect of doing that? You know, if I feel like I have to apologize again and again for even being in the conversation, what if I just said what I had to say and then stopped? That's a good, every, you know, those, when you can feel that kind of an edge, or that's like a cliff, and that's a good place of practice, right? yeah, great. Yeah.
What if, when somebody, let's say, to say harsh speech, reveals in a way that just like, when you're burying your soul or opening your heart, but what is seen, what I saw, was just this person was using the harsh speech. It was just, they had so much fear in this particular person. I could see it, you know, it was physical, like mental, I could look and feel it coming out of this person very strongly. And there was a little more visual stuff that went through that, but, you know, I was probably a mess in the beginning for speaking before I thought completely, but the response was not what I expected. And I was at a moment when I was pretty receptive, I was getting ready to go into meditation. So how do you, in a way I dealt with it, was to speak to the person about the harsh speech, or not the harsh speech, but what I saw of them bearing their soul or opening their heart. And I mean, it just was really strange to me how to deal with this, and I didn't really know what to do.
Mm.
And then also there was a part about that person had some other speech that wasn't so well that I had to deal with, which I had to deal with separately.
Mm.
Anyway, that just the whole, you know, not always when somebody bares their soul or opens the heart, it's really something beautiful to look at.
Yeah. So his comment was about someone who, in his experience, was speaking from the heart, opening the heart, but there seemed to be expressing a lot of fear, and the fear was generating harshness. And so he was wondering how to.
I could see all the way back to his childhood.
Yeah, how to be, so being able to, of his perception of fear driving harshness, and so how to respond to that. So a couple of weeks ago, I spoke more about listening, about how to be in the listening mode, and some of the assumptions that we can make around listening are that we know exactly what's going on for someone. So that's a good one to check. We may have a sense of, oh, there's this, we can sense when someone's afraid or in distress, especially if we've been with our own mind enough times around fear and distress. So, oh, this is how it's coming out of this person. So maybe there isn't a lot that we need to really do or can do in that situation other than to just know, oh, there's fear, just like we would in our own minds. Oh, there's fear there. So if there's harshness that we feel like really needs a response, you know, sometimes fear just needs some containment, some not to, to reflect back more fear or judgment or, you know, volleying back harshness. Sometimes the most skillful thing is just to see, oh, this is fear. To kind of let the content that's coming at you to the degree that you're able to, let the content go. Say, oh, this is fear.
Yeah, I did all of those things, and I meditated on some, and then I made a time with the person.
Yeah.
I could explain what I saw, the mentally, the vision I had, and the,
mm-hmm.
and the fear that went all the way back, you know, deep fear, you know,
yeah.
like something he had on the surface.
Yeah.
But we talked, and I don't know if I was able to use the right words, but
mm-hmm.
at least I brought it up. But
yeah.
it was later. It wasn't immediate. I just went into silence at that point.
Right. Yeah, so sometimes we get a lot of insights about our own mind, sometimes about other people's mind. Sometimes those are helpful, sometimes they're not. But again, like not to conflate who that person is with that mental state at that time. And also it sounds like exactly what you did, sensing a good time to offer a reflection is part of wise speech also. Like sensing when is there openness. Often there isn't openness to hearing, so sensing it. So thank you for that. And we probably need to close unless there's one more shortish one. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Maybe there isn't a short one around speech, right? I love these questions, though. I love this conversation. Yeah. So.
So that was one thing that I hope it was mentioned.
whatever I wanted to suggest. And the other thing was, I was realizing in thinking from your talk about speech, that perhaps many of the things that you're talking about for me apply to my thinking and my feeling, because otherwise, what is speech? It's just some sort of, like right now, confused words that are coming out of my mouth that I haven't prepared from my thought center. So for me to step back and go before the speech to all the things that we were talking about and cultivating and thinking and feeling besides being centered would enable my speech to have a better chance to flourish.
Yeah, great. Excellent. So it's a beautiful reflection and kind of a summary, too. It's the intention to talk about Sampajana is that grounding quality, that embodied knowing. And for some of us, it feels like groundedness. For others, it feels like openness of heart. But grounded, anchored in something, connected to something other than thought, right? And so reflecting on speech as a externalization of thought, yeah, arising out of the mind. So I'd love to continue, but I think we need to stop for tonight. So I hope that this informs your own practice and reflection going forward, and that you can take kind of whatever's interesting or useful, whatever's been of benefit, and really take it and work with it in your own practice. So thank you. And in the end, as powerful and wonderful and potentially harmful as speech can be, it is insubstantial. It's just like thought. It just evaporates. So it's kind of miraculous that way. So approaching your practice with this wonder and curiosity is much more helpful than another set of shoulds. Okay, so, all right, thank you.